Hello and welcome to another edition of the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Today's episode is one of an occasional series examining the lives and work of some of the great folklorists of the past. Charlotte Sophia Byrne, born in 1850 and living until 1923, was a writer and author who's best known for a number of achievements. Her definitive book on the folklore of the county of Shropshire, her work on the second revision of the Handbook of Folklore, and possibly most notably, the fact that she was not only the first female president of the Folklore Society, but also probably the first female president of any learned society in the United Kingdom. Where other folklorists of her time directed much of their attention to looking at works previously published by other scholars and putting forward their own theories, Charlotte was a pioneer in fieldwork, getting out and speaking to people, observing and recording their beliefs and customs. Joining me to profile this important contributor to the subject is Nicole Stout. Nicole is not only the author of a new book which represents Charlotte in an innovative way, but is also a direct descendant, and the keeper of the only known surviving notebooks of hers. Nicole, welcome to the Folklore Podcast. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Before we kick off, I'll just ask you to say a little bit about yourself and your interests and how you work with folklore and what you do, and then we can move on from there to talking about today's topic.
So my name's Nicole Stout, and I recently published a book called Unexpected Companions, which focuses on three women, one of which was Charlotte Sophia Byrne. And my interest in folklore is really through Charlotte Byrne, because she was my great-grandfather's aunt, which is the easiest way to explain that rather than lots of greats. But she was basically an ancestor of mine and a much loved figure in our family. So that is where my interest in folklore has come from and where my study has been focused.
And indeed, she is a much loved figure within folklore collection generally, I think it's fair to say, and definitely one of this country's great folklore collectors. So we will come to your book in a little while, but first off, let's have a little chat about Charlotte. Now, I think it's fair to say that folklore collecting kind of had a real peak in one respect, in the kind of Victorian Edwardian era through to maybe the middle of the 20th century, and things have changed a little bit in how people work with folklore then. But to my mind, there are kind of two camps here. There are the middle class, wealthy / upper class, respectable gentlemen who went out and found objects and artifacts and made museums. And then there are the same kind of society class of ladies who are responsible for collecting so much of our folklore and social history and recording it, for which we should be extremely grateful. And I think I would place Charlotte into that camp of those kinds of middle class respectable ladies who had a love of the field. Is that fair to say?
I would agree with that entirely. She started her collecting from quite an early age, but she very much was one of those in that camp that wanted to go out and be in the field. And perhaps that's where she, there was a group of them, the likes of Lady Alice Gome, I guess I would also put in that sort of field, who went out into the communities to learn more around what was being spoken about and discussed. And Charlotte was at the forefront of doing that, of encouraging more field work in its literal sense, rather than going into a library and picking up a book and sort of finding out bits and pieces through that.
One of the books for which Charlotte is responsible is The Handbook of Folklore, which is a wonderful book, and I'll get you to talk a little bit about that in a moment. But before that, it's worth saying that Charlotte was quite a character, I think it's fair to say, and certainly of her time in many ways. And I was just going to read the opening paragraph of the preface from the Handbook of Folklore, which I think paints a wonderful picture of the kind of person that I think we could say that Charlotte was. So she writes in the beginning of this book, "This book is not written for the use of members of anthropological expeditions whose work demands far more thorough acquaintance with the subject than could possibly be conveyed in a single volume. It is addressed to officers of the public services, to missionaries, travellers, settlers, and others whose lot is cast among uncivilised or half-civilised populations abroad, to residents in country places at home, to medical men, philanthropic workers, and all educated persons whose lives and duties bring them into touch with the uneducated." How does that paint a picture of Charlotte?
In two ways. Let's start with the language, because the language is definitely of its time, and her research and what she wrote down and collected is extremely incredible. But behind that, when you're reading the stories, there is that very Victorian, you know, upper class attitude that this folklore thing was something that the poor people, and I'm using inverted commas on that, believed in because they were, you know, of a more simple nature perhaps, and that does isn't that comfortable to read from a modern day perspective, for sure. But if you go past that, however, what she was trying to do with both the handbook and with writings that she did in her earlier years, there is a huge push to have encourage people to be more methodical in how they are collecting their folklore. And that was really what the handbook was there to try to help people with, to think beyond just taking that one piece of folklore that they've got, whether it be a saying or a superstition, and to understand where that is coming from and to ask around that that one snippet as much as they could, and to get a sense of the historical, geographical, and cultural context that piece of folklore was from. You can sense in that preface just her. She's a no nonsense kind of person, and she really would pull people up for referencing something incorrectly. And she used at least one of her presidential addresses, if not both, to make that point with a saying that had come through from Oxfordshire, the little white dog. Where someone had heard somebody be described who was lazing around in a field as, he's got the little white dog. And this person who'd collected this piece of reference thought it was to do with what they'd heard in northern France, where such sayings were linked to corn spirits. And she was very keen on making the point that you have to understand the cultural community that you're in to realize that actually they're referring far more to, they make those sort of references around diseases more than they do around and this sort of, is very common for that. And she makes the point about, you have to understand that in these sort of farming communities, you will have all the animals working. They all have a purpose. They all earn their keep, apart from the little white dog who sits in front of the fireplace and does nothing and is idle. And so it's effectively a reference to somebody being idle is somebody having the little white dog. And that's what she's very keen on all her life, is making sure that people, when they're collecting this folklore, are doing it in a methodical and systematic way. And you really see that in the handbook that that's what she's trying to encourage.
And when you say her, one of her presidential addresses, of course, she was the first female president of the Folklore Society, which in itself was quite a feat, wasn't it? Now, how did Charlotte get involved in this in the first place? What sparked her interest in folklore, and how did she come to start collecting it?
From a very early age, she says that the first time she came across folklore, she was on a boat with her father. And these would have been sailboats of sorts. And her father was whistling, and the sailor turned to her father and said, told him to stop whistling because we've got enough wind as it is without you whistling for more. And she thought that was curious, and as any 7-year-old would do, got out a notebook and jotted it down. and that was really the start, and she kept notebooks all through her life. And you know, we sadly don't have many that have survived, and the ones that we do, the earliest comes from when she would have been just turning 13, 1863, and there you see lots of different references, not only to folklore, but the natural world and history. So it was a broad interest she had, but folklore really caught her imagination. And then she, in 1872, she wrote a piece on local folklore for the Severn Valley Naturalist Field Club. And that was really what propelled her forwards, because a lady called Georgina Jackson saw this piece and wanted to speak to her. And Georgina Jackson was also a folklore collector, particularly interested in dialect. And she was collecting Shropshire folklore, but also Shropshire words. And she employed Charlotte to help her, first of all, with the dialect work, but then into the to help her collect pieces for the Shropshire folklore, because she wanted to write a book. And unfortunately for Georgina, she became too ill to actually see through the book, and so it fell a lot to Charlotte to continue that and to actually collect and edit a book, which then became Shropshire Folklore, Sheaf of Gleanings. And that was what brought her into the circle, which was Folklore Society and that community.
You mentioned her notebooks there. There are, what, 3 remaining notebooks which you have, don't you?
That's right.
Yeah. And also, I'll talk more about this when I wrap this programme up at the end, but just to say as well that we are very fortunate that Nicole has digitised those notebooks, which we now hold in the Folklore Library and Archive, and which are available for research purposes if people want to access them in that way. I'll talk about that later, but they're quite a recent addition, but pleasing to know they have been requested twice already by researchers to have a look at, which is fantastic. So Charlotte's work is still very much useful to people to this day. Now you talk about the way that she got into that there. What did her family make of this?
I'd say it was mixed. Her mother was very supportive, and that's reflected across her entire educational experiences, because her mother, Charlotte Anna, I'll call her mother Charlotte Anna to differentiate her from Charlotte. They did like to name each other the same names. So Charlotte Anna had come from a very cultured, educated background, and she certainly imposed and encouraged that on her children, the girls as much as the boys. And Charlotte Anna was certainly the one that encouraged the folklore interest, although I don't believe she was necessarily that interested in it herself. One of the pieces that Lottie writes about pace eggs talks about the fact that she was quizzing her mother on sort of what was happening on during the Easter period when her mother lived in Bury. And the end result was that Charlotte concluded that her mother was not that interested in observing it because she couldn't remember any of it. And so Charlotte Anna was really there to encourage Charlotte's interest rather than necessarily because she had one herself. But nevertheless, it was actually through her mother that Charlotte and Georgina Jackson were connected, because there's this wonderful letter that Charlotte Turner writes to her daughter saying, basically to paraphrase it, I don't really care if you don't want to meet this woman. I think you should meet her. So you're going to meet her. and she did. And, you know, the rest of that was history. I also believe that Charlotte Turner was one of the first subscribers for the Folklore Record, if my memory serves me correctly. And so again, she was there encouraging that connection for Charlotte. The broader family were perhaps less impressed by folklore. She had a number of unmarried aunts who lived in the Byrne family house, which was called Loynton Hall. And they were not at all interested. And at one point, Charlotte had brought over a manuscript for them to read and have a look at the behest of Charlotte Anna. And the aunt writes about how it was a bit dull and it sort of went on. And I think that really sums up how a lot of the family felt about Charlotte's interest. However, what perhaps she didn't see within her generation and the older generation was she did then see in terms of interest in the younger generations, her nephews and younger cousins were very interested and were involved in it and were actually part of some of them were part of the conversation as the International Folklore Congress that she helped to organize. And her nephew, Arthur Byrne, wrote quite a lot for the folklore later in life. So it was mixed.
She published quite a lot, didn't she, during her time? And as you say, unfortunately, not much of her research material survives now, just these very few notebooks, which is a great shame, but not unusual for a lot of these sorts of archives of collection, which there was not provision made for stuff to happen to this kind of material when people died and whatever, and so often it just got skipped or trashed or lost or whatever. But she did publish quite a lot, didn't she? So that's both books and articles.
Yes, she did publish a lot. She published first off the Shropshire folklore book. And then she wrote almost consistently from the time that she joined the Folklore Society in 1883, various articles for them. She wrote for other pieces as well. She for a while was involved with the Cheltenham Ladies College, and we have at least one article that she wrote from her time with them. As well as the nephew Arthur Byrne was involved in the North Staffordshire Field Club, and she also wrote for him as well. So all through, mainly, I would say mainly articles, really, in terms of if you were going to count it in terms of numbers, in terms of pages, Shropshire Folklore is quite a tome of a book, so that might still beat all the articles put together.
And how was her work received generally?
The Shropshire Folklore book was really well received and was complimented hugely at the time. It was seen as a bit of a vanguard for being such an extensive collection of county folklore. It wasn't the first county folklore collection, but it was perhaps the most extensive and the most scientific, arguably. And so it was very well regarded, and her general writing was again, you know, she was part of a group of people pushing for the scientific approach and pushing for that sort of referencing things, and that was something that was on the whole the way that the society was going.
In its early days, the Folklore Society, like a lot of other learned societies, was very much the realm of the patriarchy, and it took a while for ladies such as Charlotte to be able to really find a hold in more senior positions like she did. And there have been, you know, throughout the UK, some absolutely marvellous female folklorists back in that time, you know, and going forward from Charlotte, Catherine Briggs, you know, Venetia Newell, Theo Brown, lots and lots. But like so many other things for women, it was a bit of a struggle to get to that position. Do you think that Charlotte's somewhat formidable character helped her to find a position in that way?
I definitely don't think it was a negative for her. She knew what she wanted, and she was also incredibly reliable. Sounds the wrong word, but you know, she was a consistent part of, in terms of writing pieces and being present. And she went from 1883 from being just a member to 1887 being part of the council. And at that point on, you really get the sense that she is an invaluable linchpin for a lot of things. She helped Sir Lawrence Gome framework the first folklore handbook. And then a year later, she's in two committees for the International Folklore Congress. So there's an element of her personality which has just so much energy and force and intellect that I think if she wanted to do something, then it was probably very difficult to say no to her. And by later years, you get the sense that they were very reliant on her. She was editor of the journal for, I mean, the best part of 8 or 9 years. And when she the year she resigned, they sort of procrastinated for about 6 months because they basically didn't want her to resign. And it came to November and of 1908, and they still hadn't actually appointed anybody else. And so they went back to her and said, are you sure? Are you sure you don't want to carry on? And she was like, you know, a very terse letter, like you say, you know, she didn't beat around the bush on these things. And so they then had to go and find somebody else relatively last minute. But within a week of having decided that she's, you're realizing she's not going to be editor, they then went back to her and said, well, in which case will you be president? So I think she came from a very unusual background, not in terms of landed gentry wealth, but I think in terms of the influences around her. Her father died when she was very young, and she was brought up surrounded by aunts and grandmothers and a lot of female presences. And I think that had perhaps an influence in how she saw the world and sort of not necessarily afraid of being in a room full of men. I mean, she really was the only woman on the council for a lot of the time.
So Charlotte was the first female member of the Folklore Society to become president. And she was very well respected for her research in many ways, as you say. Did she get on with everybody? Did everybody agree with what she was doing, or were there still other dynamics at play?
You can never know for sure on these things. However, I think that there was almost two groups. There was the group that felt that, a scientific approach was appropriate and that, and the methodical side to it. But I know for sure that she was a very firm believer in in survivalism of folklore, that these things came through from different time periods and were just reflected slightly differently according to the present in terms of like modern folklore. And I know that that was something that wasn't agreed with everyone. When she wrote her, I think it was the 1911, but anyway, one of the presidential addresses, she refers to the fact that there are others who would dispute survivalism. And I think that's a slight dig at Gaster, who was the president before her, who was quite vocal about being quite cynical about it. And she gave some examples to try to sort of explain where she was coming from. You know, again, her love of cross-referencing means she can never just make a statement. And the one I particularly like was around Pontus Hill, where they, on Palm Sunday every year, will go up to look for the golden arrow. And she explains that this golden arrow is believed to have been left by a king who fell in battle, and then points out that around this area, Pontesford Hill or somewhere nearby, there was actually a battle between the West Saxons and the Welsh in 661 AD. And so you get so she's bringing that point back about how something that was happening to that day had some kind of historical context that may well be where that folklore was coming from, and hence that sort of survivalism element to it. So she was a very vocal on that belief.
Is there anything else about her which we haven't covered that you think we ought to mention before we move on?
I think the only other thing I would add is her interest in calendar customs. It was a huge part of her of the Shropshire folklore book. She dedicated a large chunk to not only, you know, to my mind, the obvious ones of Christmas and Easter and Halloween sort of thing, but also every other day that might be celebrated in between. And, you know, she comments on things like Mothering Sunday as this concept that some parts of Shropshire do, which I found quite interesting to read about given Mother's Day these days. And so that was a large part. And with the notebooks that she wrote, one of the first notes that we have from her on folklore is actually of May Day in Devon, where she comments on the fact that girls were going to houses with their dolls all, you know, gaily dressed up, and they would expect pennies for sort of showing this display. And right at the bottom, after she'd written this, she wrote, "And a similar custom, I believe, happens in Leicestershire." And so you've really got this sense of somebody from an early age who was very interested in these sort of festivities and moments that were being marked one way or another. And her last project that she was still doing when she died in 1923 was an updated version of Brand's Antiquities, the Calendar Customs area. And her presidential address in 1911 announced this project and that they were going to be doing this. And that, to me, says something, because, you know, this was obviously an area that she would have had influence on deciding what got picked and what got assessed. And it was calendar customs that she did. So I think that that's quite an interesting element of Charlotte, was that she was always very interested in how people marked the year.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the May dolls. That's something I've written about myself, actually, and it's recorded on a few occasions in the Transactions of the Devonshire Association, this whole custom of very, very ornately decorated dolls, in some cases being taken around in shoeboxes and just presented at people's doors and going, look, here's my doll, give me some money. it's a much nicer version of Penny for the Guy, if you like.
Yeah, no, it sounds sweet.
She never married. What do we know about her personal life?
Very little, really. The family law, which I did take slight advantage of in my book, was that there was a love interest, but it never came to anything. And how true that is, genuinely, we just don't really know. I can't imagine that there wasn't any sort of romantic interests for her. But I also think that just who she was and what she was interested in, she was basically a bit more interested in going traveling and speaking to people and sort of working rather than looking around for a husband. A husband, certainly in Victorian times, came with a lot of baggage, expectations on what you were going to do. And it was very unusual to therefore be able to go off and do what she wanted to do.
I think many people would argue that a husband still brings a lot of baggage. you mentioned your book there, so let's talk a little bit about your book. Tell everybody the premise of Unexpected Companions.
So the premise of it is it's based on three women who all led remarkable lives that broke the social norm. And it started with the idea of researching my mother-in-law's grandmother, who we knew very little about. And from that family research, I wanted to write about this lady called Amy Mellow. And what I discovered was that what I felt was appropriate was actually that there were more than one person in the family that had led a life that was different, that had inspiration, that had sort of paved the way for future generations of women. And those other two was my grandmother, Winifred Byrne, who went from an incredibly poor tenant farming family in Wales to be a nurse at Westminster Hospital. And she married Charlotte Byrne's great nephew, John Byrne. And so those were sort of the three women that I wanted to focus on. And I set them in a slightly supernatural scenario where they are meeting a future descendant and talking to the future descendant, try to help her with some problems. And they do this over dinner. And what I found with Charlotte was that although I expected to write a lot more about her time in the Folklore Society and the fact that, as you said, she was the first woman president and all the rest. And actually what I got drawn in on was the folklore itself and the beliefs and the superstitions and the stories behind so much. And so the book I decided to base on Halloween because I felt that that was appropriate, not only from a sort of an ancestor worship and feast of the dead sort of concept, but also because of the fact that it was bringing back some of that folklore. And then I used a lot of what I had read through Lottie's writings and slightly beyond, but mainly I was inspired by what Lottie had collected, and I put that through the book as well. And most of it I tried to either put within Lottie. I'm sorry, I'm saying Lottie because that's how the family always referred to her, because there's too many Charlottes in the family. So let me go back to calling her Charlotte before everyone wonders who I'm talking about. So I tried to use her own words as much as possible is what I'm trying to say, both within family letters and within the writing itself. And I did that across the three women as much as I could, but I was very fortunate with Charlotte that not only do we have her public writing, but we also have a lot of her private writings. And so my intention was to try to give these women voices when their stories hadn't been told through life. And with Amy and my granny, a lot of it was, my granny being Winifred, a lot of it was unknown and had to kind of be dug up. And then the other side with Charlotte was that it was all there, but actually some of it was also family lore and not quite correct when you started to read the letters and the diaries behind it all.
And some of those family letters of Charlotte's are included as part of these notebooks, aren't they? Now, is that her making copies of letters for her own later reference?
Yes, I believe it is. They are, I mean, the letters in the notebook that you're referring to, they are between her grandmother, Mary. Some of them are between Mary Goodlad, who was her grandmother, and her daughters, so Charlotte, Anna, and Charlotte Anna was one of five girls and six siblings. And also the older generation to that, which was the Haworths, so Mary Goodlad's writings, as well as her mother to her as well. So they go back quite a way, and they are Charlotte writing them down and recording them for posterity. And there's even one that has no family connection, but is one she came across going to visit somebody else, and they had this tragic letter written by the daughter who was out in India during the Indian mutiny, and about the fact that she didn't know where her husband was, and she didn't know where her baby was, and you know, it's incredibly heart-wrenching to read. And but there's Lottie, I'm sorry, there's Charlotte just sort of writing it down in her notebook and sort of making the point about it. So she was one for recording for posterity and for history as much as for folklore.
And we should certainly be thankful that at least some of that does survive, because it does give a really interesting insight into not only her life, but the time in which she was living in that way as well. How did you go about doing the research, not just about Charlotte, but about Amy and Winifred as well, to draw everything together? I know some of it has to be speculation, of course, because there is not that much detail surviving, as you include in the book. But how did you set about trying to essentially do a fairly major project in family history and then turn it into this, what is, because I really enjoyed it, a very, very engaging read for anybody who is not related to you?
Thank you very much. It depended on who I was researching, to be honest with you. For Amy Mellow, we actually had the name of her first husband as John, when it was actually Joseph. So my first port of call with her was Ancestry, the online, you know, family tree service, and there are others as well. I also used Family Search and a number of them, but basically I went onto the online systems to see what I could find. And as the story grew with the information I had, I also contacted various archives to see if they could give me the documents, the death certificates and birth certificates that I needed. And I spoke to family members, which is a dangerous thing, as I sort of put at the back of my book, because you, like any family story, it's similar with, you know, the folklore, you need to cross-reference these things, because what is told down the line or what gets assumed by implication often isn't actually what happened. And that was a common occurrence actually with Amy Mellow's story, because I just don't think she shared a lot of it at all. And then with my granny, with Winifred Davies, again, she never spoke about her childhood. And she had a challenging upbringing, similar to Charlotte, well, not similar to Charlotte's, but she had the tragedy of also not having a father who was around for her childhood. And that the mystery behind why that was had never been told. My grandfather genuinely never knew where her father was that he'd been absent. And so researching that and looking into that and piecing out family law versus what actually the records would tell you was very interesting. And again, with Charlotte, it was the letters and the articles, and my grandfather, John Byrne, had really saved me a lot of time, because we have, I want to say mountains, which is obviously an exaggeration, but we have four huge files of letters dating back to the 1800s. And I will own that I haven't read them all, but I basically read all of the ones through Charlotte's lifetime, and he had very kindly gone through them all and recorded them and tried to put them into some sort of chronological order. Being my grandfather, he'd done it with Biro, so you've got these 1850 letters with 1850 and Biro written on them, which is perhaps not great from a like purist's perspective, but was very useful. And so those are how I found their stories. And then it was really about trying to piece their stories together in a way that made sense from a plot arc and that you could draw on, because they were also very different personalities. I feel that Amy Mellor was, again, a very, well, they were all strong people, but Amy was very self-assured as well as Charlotte, and very vocal with that, and knew her mind and knew what she wanted and wasn't afraid to say so. And so I enjoyed having that dynamic across the dinner table, where you can just imagine the sort of the awkwardness that would sometimes erupt from having two people not afraid to say something and wanting to hold that conversation to themselves.
And Charlotte was a lover of food, wasn't she, as well?
She was, and you see that in the letters and the diaries. They're always commenting on food, on, you know, they went somewhere and they had tea, and then they went here and they had tea, and today I made parkin and I made marmalade, and, you know, there's a lot of references throughout about their food.
Yeah, it's again culturally interesting from that point of view as well, to see just what, you know, what people were eating, what they were doing at that time. As I say, it's a really fantastic story as well as having this historical element in the book. It's funny in places. It has pathos. You know, it's kind of crosses the whole gamut of emotions in a way which you'd expect for a book of that type. So I would urge anybody to have a look at it. If people want to get a copy, where should they go?
They can come to my website, which is nicolestout.co.uk, or they can go to Amazon, where it's also available.
I would urge everybody to get a copy directly from Nicole. It will benefit her much better that way, I'm sure.
It will, and I will sign it.
Even better. Have you considered doing anything else with all of this material that you've gathered now?
I have a project in the background. So I would like to write a second book, which will be with family dynamics and folklore within it. I grew up in Jersey, so I feel that I want to explore the folklore of Jersey, because there's quite a lot there as well. However, I feel that the project with Charlotte is never done. And one of the things that I've been looking at recently is how her, looking at the letters and the diaries and comparing that to her Shropshire folklore, and trying to tie in, you know, where she was when she was writing some of this, because she was very good at referencing back on where pieces, on, you know, the time and the place that she was. And then you can go to the diary and you can see that Alice, because they were never her diaries, sadly, they were Alice's diaries, her youngest sister. But Alice would write, you know, Charlotte has gone to Albrighton, and then you'd have this reference to Charlotte being in Albrighton doing this research. So I quite enjoyed that. So I might try to see if I can piece something together that would look remotely interesting from a broader perspective, rather than just my own curiosities. But my main next project will be coming up with another fictional story using family dynamics and folklore.
With the same characters or with different characters?
With different characters. There has been a request for a sequel to this, and I do feel that there is quite a lot that was left unsaid, especially sort of their later lives. And so I might let Ellie grow up a bit and then bring them all back together in some slightly different format, because I would love to write a bit more on them and explore some of the stuff that didn't get into this first book.
And I think it would be very well received too, and it's certainly a very rich vein to tap into there, I think, as well. Nicole, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk about this. I think Charlotte is a really important character in British folklore, and you, as much as anybody now, has done a lot to bring that to people's attention and to ensure that what is remaining of what she did is at least preserved and accessible and people know about it. So I thank you for that, and thank you for coming to talk to us about her today.
Pleasure. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a delight.
I'm grateful to Nicole not only for giving up her time to chat to me about Charlotte's life, but also for facilitating the depositing of digitised copies of Charlotte's notebooks in the Folklore Library and Archive. You can find out more by visiting the website at www.folklorelibrary.com and visiting the document archives. This was episode 99 of the main podcast, meaning that we reach a milestone episode 100 next time. More about my special guest for that one in just a moment. In the meantime, I just want to note that we've restructured the output of the Folklore podcast across all of our projects recently. Now, supporting the Patreon page at www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast will help not only this show, but also the book club and, additionally, the vital work being done through the Folklore Library and Archive to save, preserve and make available folklore records and research for the future. Support still begins at just £1 a month, but extra content is now drawn from across our projects. Also, if you believe in the work of the Folklore Library and Archive, which is run purely voluntarily, but which has already amassed thousands of pages of important documents which would otherwise have been lost, then you can make a donation on the website at www.folklorelibrary.com/fundraising. You'll be able to see on there what our current goals are for money raised, all of which is put into the running of the Library and Archive. We're delighted to announce that the Library and Archive now has a patron in the form of Michael Rosen. He believed in what we were doing and was gracious in accepting the role, and we're extremely grateful for his support. Next time, for our 100th episode, which will be a feature-length talk, I'll be speaking with anthropologist and TV presenter Mary Ann Ohotta, who you may have seen on Time Team, Sky News, documentary programmes for the Smithsonian, or in many other places. Mary Ann and I will be discussing folklore in the landscape. I hope that you can join us. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.